Welcome to the Irish Tech News Podcast, where we will bring you some of the most interesting interviews and features from the world of tech. Visit irishtechnews.ie and check out our podcast section to explore all of our previous episodes. You can subscribe to our podcast using whatever your favorite app or service is by visiting anchor.fm/irish-tech-news.
Hi, welcome to today's podcast. Today in the podcast, we have Professor Nick Bostrom. How are you doing, Professor Bostrom?
Howdy.
So before we start, tell us a bit about your background so know who you are.
Well, I'm currently a professor at Oxford University, where I've been running this multidisciplinary research institute called the Future of Humanity Institute for, I guess, 19 years now. Originally grew up in Sweden, but I myself on this research center has been trying to study big picture questions for humanity, and in particular ways that emerging new technologies might in some ways fundamentally transform the human condition.
Yeah, so I guess, for example, you might be saying, like, I know in your book, you talk a bit about your book you'd written, a new book called Deep Utopia, Life and Meaning in the Solved Worlds. In that, you mentioned basically that some jobs are going to be gone. They're going to be replaced by AI. And how do we handle that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are sort of in still the early stages of a ramp up of AI capabilities that will just keep climbing at a rapid incline, and that we will see AI systems that, well, we're already seeing ones that have sort of rudimentary forms of general intelligence and learning capability. And I think they will become more capable as we keep scaling them up. So that within a relatively short time frame, it's uncertain, but it could be like a few years or a few decades, I think we will develop AI systems that have all the cognitive capabilities that humans have. And then after that, superhuman levels of cognitive capability. Yeah. And that will allow us to automate basically all jobs. With the exception of jobs where the consumer specifically cares not just about the product, but about how the product was produced.
Yeah.
So, like you might imagine, there's still being demand for instance, for human athletes. Like even if robots could run faster, kick a ball better, like people might still prefer to watch humans run and play football rather than robots.
Yeah.
Or if you have a wedding, maybe you want a human to officiate, to be the priest, rather than a robot, even if the robot could say the same words with the same tone of voice and everything. So those would be sort of carve-outs where there you could imagine even at like unlimited advanced technology, there would still be demand for human labor. But aside from those exceptions, I think AIs and robots will be able to do everything and then do it much better and cheaper and faster than any human could.
Well, I know, for example, if you look at some Hollywood movies in the past and you see things like where they have robot taxis, as in the Jimmy cabs in Total Recall, that could be more prevalent. And that could be the new Uber, for example.
Yeah. So that will be one area where like robotics, because really like a car, self-driving car is really a kind of robot, right?
Yeah.
It's just differently. It has wheels instead of arms, but the technology is basically the same. But once you have this general intelligence that frontier AI labs are now trying to build, then it really, one shouldn't think of it as kind of one more cool little technology like we have, I don't know, the internet or the mobile internet, or like people get like excited about the next new thing. But it's really a more fundamental transformation and shift from a kind of human era to a machine intelligence era, where there must still be humans around to hopefully enjoy the abundance that we can create. But further research and development at that point would be driven by these machine minds rather than by human researchers. And so I think we really, if we want to look back at some historical parallel, I think don't think of it as a particular technology, think of it more as akin to the rise of the human species in the first place, or maybe life on Earth.
Yeah.
This is really a monumental transition that will likely happen.
Yeah, because for me, I'm thinking of like right now, I know people who've got kids, and the kids always going, hey Siri, to ask questions. And I think in the future, Siri is going to be is going to be way more advanced than it is now, and things like that are going to change.
Yeah, they're already. Yeah, I think. I mean, one mistake that people sometimes make when they think, "What is this AI thing?" and then they look at current AI systems and they think that's the AI thing. But this is a moving target, and if you compare ChatGPT-4, which is the current most advanced model, to like ChatGPT-2, let us say, like just a few years ago, but it's night and day different.
Yeah.
ChatGPT-2 was not really useful for anything, and now people are using ChatGPT-4 for a whole wide range of tasks. So then imagine like ChatGPT-6, let's say, in like 3, 4, 5 years from now. If development continues in the same rate, like, yeah, it kind of boggles the mind of what these systems will be able to do.
To me, it's a bit like Moore's Law. Every 18 months, technology doubles. And I can just see one day when AI will be a sentient being at some point.
Yeah. And it's not entirely obvious to me that that day hasn't already arrived. We don't have very clear grasp of the criteria for a system being sentient.
Yeah.
Like people have different theories about consciousness, and there's a lot of uncertainty about what those criteria are and then how they would apply to, say, current large language models. But I think certainly from this point on, and as we build more sophisticated systems, this will, I think, become an increasingly important question, like whether some of these systems might have either degrees of sentience. And you remember, probably it doesn't take like a fully human level mind to have sentience. We think like a dog can, have feelings, or even a mouse can feel pleasure and pain and stuff. So current AI systems certainly seem as smart as a mouse in a lot of respects, right? So I think that will be a big sort of philosophical and ethical and ultimately political issue of like, how can we ensure we build a future that in the final reckoning is great for humans, but also great for these other possibly sentient minds that we will co-inhabit the planet with.
Yeah, I'm thinking back of years ago, a movie called War Games, when in the end the computer was sentient and realized that it couldn't win tic-tac-toe. So it then it realized I can't do anything else, so it stopped what it was doing.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't really see how you get from the first to the second. Like the inability to win tic-tac-toe, I'm not sure how from that one could reach the conclusion that nothing is worth doing.
Yeah, this was basically a movie that was filmed in the early 80s, and At that time, a lot of AI stuff with Hollywood doing these really weird plots and everything else that never happened. And then suddenly, some things that Hollywood has done has happened, but a lot of it hasn't. They don't know where it's going to go, so they give you these outlandish stories.
Yeah, I mean, movies and fiction is problematic as a source of information about the future. On the one hand, it can open our imagination and like make us think more broadly, which is good. On the other hand, when you're writing a story, you're also subject to constraints other than trying to be as accurate as possible about the future, which is hard enough on its own right. Yeah. But when you're telling a story, you also have to have a good plot with interesting characters and a sequence of dramatic events. And so when you add that constraint, then it becomes a lot harder to also be maximally realistic and plausible about what's actually going to happen. So I think one needs to consider that there's this kind of good story bias in everything we see and read about this in a fictional context.
But then look at Isaac Asimov and his laws of robotics, which more or less has been used now as a way of with AI to make sure that it's ethically sound.
Yeah. So I wrote this book back in, it came out in 2014 called Superintelligence, but it was in the works for like 6 years before. At that time, the whole question of, having human level intelligence in the first place, or let alone superintelligence, or the idea that it could potentially pose big risks and that it would be hard to align these systems to human values, that was universally neglected in academia, certainly. Like there was nobody taking this seriously. There were maybe like a handful of people scattered around the world over the internet trying to sort of, and so one reason for writing this book was precisely to draw attention to this, that at some point AI will succeed, and at that point we better have figured out how to control these systems and make them safe and aligned with human intentions. Now, since 2014, there's been a big shift. So now all the frontier AI labs, Google DeepMind, OpenAI, Anthropic, they all have research teams now specifically working on trying to develop scalable methods for AI control.
Yeah.
Methods that will continue to work no matter how smart the AI system becomes. So that's a big shift. And in the last 2 years, of course, we've also seen these questions enter the policy space with a series of statements coming out of the White House. The UK had the global summit on AI last year. I was just the other week in Brussels for a high-level UN meeting. And so just as fascinating as it has been to see the technology progress, this concomitant shift in the global discourse has also been quite remarkable for somebody kind of on the inside of this, just to see how much something that initially just was dismissed as science fiction and kind of people snickered at, and then just over a few years kind of becoming a very serious and like widely recognized major issue for the global conversation.
Yeah, because people might think, oh, we're going to get a new Skynet. And I'd say, well, actually, Skynet is just something in a movie. It's not a reality. And hopefully what we're doing now, we will ensure that will never happen.
Yeah, indeed. There are like several big challenges that we'll need to surmount to get, I think, ultimately a great outcome from this AI transition. So one is this alignment problem, making sure the AIs don't somehow run amok and harm us as they get increasingly powerful. And then there is a, you might say, political or governance problem, which is, you could say, how to make sure that we humans don't harm each other using these AI tools to wage war or oppress one another, but that at least predominantly it's used for positive ends. And then the third big challenge I already alluded to, which is how can we make sure that we don't harm the AIs if they eventually attain degrees of sentience or moral status? So I think, each of these is a big challenge and will require sort of the best of humanity. But if we do solve all of these three challenges, then I'm like super optimistic about what the future could become. And it might be that people, you know, 100 years or 1,000 years from now, look back on the current era in horror at what our lives were like back in 2024. The idea that you have hundreds or thousands of people, or like really hundreds of millions of people with like either heart disease or cancer or Alzheimer, that you have more hundreds of thousands of people living in extreme poverty, can't feed their kids properly nutritious diets, or even just the everyday hassles, like the little headache, the stomach pain, you know, the boredom at a job that you don't enjoy, that you have to spend 8 hours at every day, like all of these things that we just take for granted, that's kind of part of the deal, that they might just like find that absolutely horrible to consider that how could people live like that, like they did back in 2024. So that would be the good scenario, right? And I do think that's actually is a possibility.
Yeah, because for me, the thing is, it's the person who designs the AI, it's whoever it is. If it's based on how they think and how they feel, that could be the issue. As long as you get somebody who you know is neutral and is not going to go and make AI in their own likeness, then it's all good.
Yeah. So that would be interesting. So right now, the leading edge AI developers are all sort of in the commercial space. So there's like some big tech companies and some smaller startups. And now they have been somewhat proactive, I would say, in trying to encourage the involvement of policymakers and trying to get governments interested in this and trying to stimulate a wider conversation. But ultimately, if this actually were to happen, superintelligence in particular, it's too big of a thing, I think, to be the exclusive province of one particular company or even really one particular nation. Because, you know, if it goes badly, if there is an existential catastrophe, we're all in the same boat. We are all like exposed to the downside risk. So that also, I think, means if it goes well, we should also all have a slice in the upside. So I think ideally this is something that really concerns all of humanity and that needs to be done ultimately for the global public good. That's That's consistent with people involved in developing it, like having extra incentives and making profits along the path. But there needs to be something in it, I think, for everybody.
Yeah, and I guess basically, if you have a degree sort of ethics, rule and regulation that we abide by, then we can guarantee that the AI is not going to be used or abused, and nothing that we can fear.
Yeah, broadly speaking, I agree with you. Like, I think like just having a little thing on your website that says these are our ethical principles, I think will not be enough.
Yeah.
I think that's a good start.
Yeah.
Aspirationally, to say that at least you're aiming for doing something vaguely positive. That's like you start there, but then over time, I think it needs to become more specific, concrete, and ultimately binding, and with appropriate kind of oversight mechanisms within the companies, etc., and in larger societal structures. And so that, because I think like this technology will be, you know, not just cool or commercially profitable, but like immensely valuable and geopolitically important.
Yeah.
And so that as the technology progresses, there will be increasingly strong forces trying to steer its development in particular directions. National security interests, major national economic competitiveness interests that come in. And so having structures of governance that are robust to those pressures that will be applied will become important.
Yeah, and I guess you got to remember that in the past 50 or 60 years, every major new technology we're using has come from military usage. Like internet was first a military product and so forth. We've got to make sure that when this happens, we've got to make sure that it doesn't still have that military aspect to it. It's more humanistic.
Yeah, and I think that remains an open question how that plays out. It used to be that actually AI was like mainly developed by academics, like these kind of like playing around with different algorithms. And yeah. So a little bit, the old expert systems were not really useful. There were a few companies building them, but they didn't really do anything. And then academics at various universities were like exploring new algorithms on a small scale. And then I'd say from around 2012 or so, it started, maybe 2010, started moving more into industry.
Yeah.
With like DeepMind particularly being an early leader in that space. And that's still where it is now. So now all the like leading edge research in AI is done by industry.
Yeah.
But it's possible at some point in the future, particularly if the kind of national security establishment realizes that this is like a game-changing technology and that there are risks involved in the development, that they will want an increasingly strong say. And you could imagine scenarios in which it becomes a kind of Manhattan Project.
Yeah.
At some point, that is still, yeah, we don't know how that will play out.
Because then I think, well, if we use AI in a certain part, like drones, for example, we're not using humans control, so we're saving lives. I mean, the less people are going to be in the battlefield.
Yeah. I think, yeah, the drone is like an obvious area of application, but really across the board, you could also imagine, say for intelligence, for surveillance, for cyber security and cyber warfare. These are all areas, even with kind of present day technology, where you could see a lot of applications. And as you progress towards higher level of applications, then it really becomes a general purpose technology, like electricity, or combustion. That can be used for all kinds of security purposes, as well as kind of becoming a key to national economic competitiveness. Like if you don't have access to leading edge AI and the hardware that is required to run leading edge AI, that you will become at a disadvantage across the board.
Yeah. Because to me, I'm thinking of it, like, for example, right now AI is being used more and more in our devices. Like if we buy a wearable device, like I've got an Apple Watch here, or even mm-hmm. iPhone, that's all got AI built in. And the more that we get AI built into the devices that we're buying, the more we have to embrace it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of exciting use cases even right now. I mean, I'm somewhat regularly use these large language models. And like when I was writing Deep Utopia, my latest book, it's not as if it could like write the book, but for example, if I wondered about the etymology of a particular word or something, I would find it easier to ask ChatGPT-4, then, I mean, I could have Googled it, but it was just easier and it gave a really nice, concise explanation of that. And so, the use cases will proliferate with, I think, current and the next generation of large language models. But again, I mean, ultimately, we need to think about where the puck is going as well. And I think if you think about what it means to mechanize intelligence, just as we have sort of mechanized physical muscle strength, like with steam engines and from then on, I think when we mechanize intelligence, that really is a fundamentally different thing than just one more cool gadget.
Yeah, because I think basically one more cool gadget is great, but we've got to think about what is the impact going to be in us long-term using that gadget? Is it going to be good or bad? And if it's good, how is it good? If it's bad, how is it bad? And how do you make sure that it doesn't overtake our lives and make our lives more lazy?
Yeah, well, that's kind of exactly the question of this recent book, which has been like kind of 5 or 6 years in the work, but just came out the other week, like Deep Utopia.
Yeah.
Where I tried to think ahead. So it's not about how to get from here to there, but it's like, what happens if AI succeeds? Suppose everything goes well. We develop super advanced technology. We prevent it from running amok and killing us. We like don't use it for warfare or press. Like just assume for the sake of the argument that we do it right.
Yeah.
And then we end up in this kind of condition where AIs can do everything we humans can do and much better. And we have huge economic abundance and super advanced technologies because the AI could then also help us develop a whole range of other technologies, like cures for all kinds of diseases, ways to improve human cognition or adjust our emotions, perfect three-dimensional virtual reality environments like space colonizing probes, all kinds of stuff, right? Yeah. But then in that condition, like what would a good human life look like? What would we do all day long? How would we find meaning and purpose? And I think those really become deep philosophical questions that touch on what we ultimately want from life. If you imagine removing a lot of these constraints that currently sort of shape our existence, right? You have to get the job because you have to make money. You have to brush your teeth because otherwise, you know, your mouth health goes down. You have to do this, that, and the other. And like most of our days are just filled with things we have to do in order to achieve something else. But in this post-instrumental condition that we would attain, all of that seemingly would fall away.
Yeah.
Because we wouldn't have to do anything. We could press the button and the AI would do it. Like you would, you know, if you wanted to be fit in a technologically mature world, you wouldn't have to spend an hour on the Stairmaster or go for long runs. You'd pop a pill and it would have the same physiological effect as working out would do. So, and you could go through activity by activity, and most of them, it seems, if they wouldn't become completely pointless, at least there would be a big question mark above them. Like what, why? And so this book really tries to dive into that and think like, what would be like a fantastic life that we could then attain if we were freed from all of these instrumental limitations that currently confine our existence?
Yeah, because normally at time right now, you're doing a job because a job has to be done, but also you're doing it because what else will you do with your life? But if you had a scenario where that wasn't an issue, then we'd have a whole new world.
Yeah, so that's kind of, there are layers of this onion. That's kind of the first layer, the outermost layer. And for like, if you just had enough money and wealth that you didn't have to work. Now, there are, of course, various human groups who are in that condition. Like people born with great wealth or maybe children, like they don't have to work for a living. They don't really do anything useful, but they still seem to have often great lives and have fun and they are very active. And it doesn't seem just because they can't like make a living that somehow that makes their existence worse. Or say retirees who are in great health mentally and physically and like are enjoying life. Or like, so there are different groups you could point to and say, well, it is possible for at least some humans with the right culture and attitude and so forth to have great lives of leisure. We can also see failure modes where for some people it becomes a curse, right? They kind of can't get out of bed. But for some people, at least, they can make something great out of that. But that's only the first layer of the onion because there's still a lot of things that somebody with plenty of economic resources have to do. Like if they want to be fit, they still have to exercise. If they want to like know mathematics, they have to study mathematics. If they, want to have a healthy mouth, they have to brush their teeth. If they,
yeah,
you know, if they want to understand somebody and make a friend, they have to spend time together and invest in the relationship. And so there's like, but you could imagine as the second layer of the onion that this also falls away because there would be AI shortcuts to the same outcomes.
And also, so then, yes, sorry, go on.
Yes, yeah, so we, so like an even larger set of our, the things we currently invest time and effort in would become unnecessary at technological maturity.
Yeah.
So that then poses a deeper problem, like of what you do to find purpose in this situation.
Yeah, and when you mentioned earlier about peeling the onion, hopefully when you peel the onion, you don't start crying, because that's what you don't want. You want happiness, yeah, and not sadness.
Sorry?
You want happiness and not sadness when you peel the onion. You see, normally when you peel the onion, you cry. But in this case, you want happiness and not sadness.
Yeah, you want happiness and not sadness. Now, one question is whether you only want happiness. So if we think of happiness as a subjective state of mind of feeling joy and pleasure and delight, that certainly would be possible at technological maturity with, like, imagine some super drug that didn't have any side effects and wasn't addictive that you could take that would elevate your mood. Or maybe it wouldn't be a pharmaceutical, maybe it would be some direct brain device that would stimulate your nucleus accumbens or other limbic systems in your brain to, so and this is indeed the third layer of the onion where you realize that it's not just that we would have a lot of money and that a lot of the tasks, yeah, we have to perform would be unnecessary, but we would also ultimately have control over our own physiological and psychological states through this technology that would allow us to sort of shape ourselves and our minds and our experiences to be whatever we preferred. So if we wanted a future with maximum pleasure, that would be attainable at technological maturity quite trivially,
yeah,
just through direct brain manipulation. And that, I mean, it certainly has something attractive to it, but a lot of people might say, well, I would ideally want a future which is more than just me being a pleasure blob, being kind of given some super drug,
yeah,
feeling maximal pleasure all the time, but then not doing experiencing or relating to other people like that might feel still less than the best we could hope for. Yeah. And I think we could do more. We could certainly, and I think should, have great levels of subjective well-being and happiness. But then on top of that, I think we could also have a bunch of other things, like meaningful relations with other people, interesting activities, perceiving beauty, being playful with inventing games and learning about the world, et cetera, et cetera. And, yeah, I think that probably is the kind of utopia that most people would steer towards rather than the purely hedonic one.
Yeah. Because the hedonic one to me sounds great, but after a while, I guarantee you'll easily get bored from it because there's nothing which is happening. Nothing new goes on there, really.
Well, I mean, you have to make a distinction here between objective boringness and subjective boredom. So subjective boredom, you certainly could avoid,
yeah,
through this neurotechnology. You just kind of, and alter some little parts of your brain that are responsible for like triggering experiences of boredom and like tune them down. Mm-hmm. This is something that's all, I mean, I have a friend and colleague actually who tells me he's never bored. And I believe him because he's like, I've never seen him the slightest sign of boredom. He's interested in everything except sport. He writes paper about all kinds of subjects, reads and learns about everything, talks to everybody. He always has like an interest and find it interesting what they are doing, whatever it happens to be. And he seems to have a great life. Like, so just the fact that he doesn't periodically feel bored doesn't seem to diminish his, if anything, it seems to make his life more interesting. And and so we could maybe all be a bit more like that. Like, yeah, some people just naturally find it hard to take an interest in things, and that might be helpful to like just tune up their ability. So subjective interest certainly could be maintained and increased.
Yeah.
It's possible, some people might think there is also an objective sense of boringness, that some things are just objectively boring.
Yeah.
However you happen subjectively to feel about it. So imagine, I have this example in my book, some person whose life consists of counting blades of grass on a college lawn.
Yeah.
So he spends morning to evening just trying to count all the leaves of grass. And he's psychologically constituted in such a way that he finds this immensely fascinating. He never gets bored. He takes great thrill and delight in counting each blade of grass. We might still think that there is something missing in his life. Like it's somehow, even though he does find joy in this, it's not an appropriate activity to take great joy and interest in because it's too monotonous or insignificant. And so if you have that objective conception of boredom, then it becomes a lot more complex to try to figure out whether there would be a sort of unlimited supply of objective interestingness in utopia. And it might be that over very long time scales, like suppose you could live for millions of years or stuff, like eventually there would be a sort of dwindling supply of objectively new interesting things to do that you hadn't done before. Like we can only discover the basic laws of physics once and then they are discovered. And maybe a million years from now, scientists will have to discover like smaller and smaller detail about the world rather than like solving consciousness or discovering general relativity or something like that.
I guess it's kind of like when man first found fire and that was changed things. And then when they invented the wheel, that again changed things. So this would is like to me that these new technologies, they change how we do things.
Yeah. And some people think, well, there might just be an unlimited number of new technologies or scientific insights or ideas we could have. But I'm not so sure. I think there might be an infinite number of them, but they are not all necessarily as profound as inventing fire or the wheel. Or, Newton's laws of physics or, you know, discovering that the world is round. Like that, there might be a kind of finite and somewhat limited set of that most fundamental type of discovery.
And then in the end
you might like discover some little detail about the stomach flora of some particular species of beetle or and smaller and smaller details about that in the fullness of time. The other thing to notice is that at some point AIs will become much better at doing this discovery than we are. So right now, I mean, certainly for academics, like for me, I take kind of a lot of my life is organized around trying to think and discover things and then trying to communicate those. And so, which gives me kind of a purpose currently. But at some point, I'm imagining I will just be superseded by machine intellects who will be doing philosophy and scientific research much better than we can. So we could still do it, but it would be more like a hobby rather than something that actually contributed to the growth of human knowledge.
Yeah. And I guess on that note, that's been a great conversation, Professor Bostrom. Thanks for that and good luck with the book and good luck with your continued.
Thank you.
I like what you're saying is very profound and interesting because people don't really think about what you're talking about how AI will it really affect us. They think of it as a way of making our lives easier. But in doing that, it also takes away things that we take for granted as well.
Yeah, and we might have to become more sort of deliberate about how we design our lives and maybe in some cases deliberately accepting limitations or hurdles in order to create interesting activity. I mean, you can already see, like, suppose somebody is playing golf, is really interested in golf. Like, they kind of impose this obstacle on the activity. They force themselves to only move the ball using a club. Like it would be easier if you just picked it up and put it in the holes in sequence, right? That would be like an easier way to, but that would also undermine the possibility of the activity that they find interesting in the first place. So they sort of deliberately just create this constraint. Let's try to do this but only using a club to hit the ball. And so then you create a game where you sort of create artificial purpose, like you deliberately make some activity harder to achieve than it would naturally have to be in order to create the opportunity for an interesting and meaningful experience or activity. And I think that might more and more of our lives might become game-like in the scenario where AI succeeds.
Well, thanks again for that, Chris Bostrom, and have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the latest Irish Tech News podcast. Check back every day for the latest episode. You can follow us on Twitter @Irish_TechNews, on Facebook, facebook.com/IrishTechNews. On LinkedIn, linkedin.com/company/Irish-Tech-News. On Instagram, instagram.com/IrishTechNews.ie. And on TikTok, tiktok.com/@IrishTechNews.